It's lights out and away they went. The new Formula One season is just around the corner. Quite a sharp corner, in fact, because pre-season testing is only just beginning. The season begins next week. This month's GP racing has arrived on the shelves. And it is, as always, at this time of year, the season preview issue. Another year, another season preview issue we've had to put together before a single car has turned a wheel in anger, which is quite annoying. Anyhow, lots of extra pages accompanied by a temporary price increase to £7.99 for this issue. Apologies for that. We even offered to chop the trees down ourselves to offset the cost of the extra paper, but something about trade unions and health and safety and not being certified to use a chainsaw. Anyway, let's bring on our guests. First up, a man with no need for cash anyway, because he's in Bahrain and has to use the new company credit card and will not be reimbursed for cash expenses. Eyelids propped up on matchsticks, it's Matt Q.
Hello, Connors. Yes, here in Bahrain, but I'm not qualified to use a chainsaw, but my brother, who does listen to Flat Chart, has lent me his hedge trimmer. It's on a long-term loan at the minute, so thank you for that. I'm well pruned, as always.
It's not an electric one like the guy who used to live next door to my father-in-law, who was constantly accidentally chainsawing through his own power cable with his hedge trimmer, and it was like the cable was like a network of gaffer tape from where it chopped it. I was once actually standing outside the house when he went through it, and there was sort of like a pop bang, and it was sort of like not again. Anyhow, we have another guest as usual. Back in sunny South Australia from his recent trip to America via Chipping Norton, where unfortunately the car key is still sitting on the hall table. It's Mark Gallagher.
Yeah, thank you for letting the listeners know that while I'm in Australia, my car keys are actually in England and we had to rent a car as a result when we got back here. But anyway, really good to catch up with you guys again. I'm very envious of you being in Bahrain. I never thought I would say those words, but I'm fascinated to see what happens in testing. And Matt, you're going to be there on the ground.
Yeah, it's my third time doing testing on Formula One, and I'm not learning from my mistakes because I'm particularly excited about this one, which I'm sure I was last year and the year before two sort of somewhat dull seasons.
We all played out, but that's good. We all need excitement in our lives.
Yeah, I mean, we'll get onto some of the various big news stories, but you know, the idea that Mercedes and Red Bull and McLaren have done one thing with their suspension. Ferrari has done the opposite. So, you know, will they be in the doldrums, and will Hamilton be looking over going, oh, Mercedes are improving, Ferrari are nowhere? You know, have Red Bull had their sort of Icarus moment with quite a big departure with the RB20, only for them to, you know, will they get that right? I'm sure they will, and it'll be a boring season, Max Verstappen dominance, but I'm really intrigued.
It has actually been packed with intrigue, hasn't it? You know, the pre-season, usually January, early February, is quite quiet, isn't it? And we were sort of expecting it to carry on like that because, and I'm quite surprised that over, you know, got about 74, 75 years of Formula One, world championship-wise, there hasn't been a season before where not one driver has moved from one team to another in the off season. So here we have everyone starting the 2024 season racing for the team with whom they finished in 2023. We have a feature written by Matt Ewson in this month's issue explaining why those circumstances prevailed. And we thought the driver market would be quiet for a while. And then Lewis Hamilton rolled his grenade under the door by having his little breakfast meeting with Toto. And before a single almond croissant had been consumed, it was like, bye. Here's my notice. What else has happened? Yeah, Dutch newspaper published allegations of serious misconduct by an F1 team principal. And just before we hit record, we were discussing the allegations that the newspaper didn't actually get those allegations legaled first, which sort of begs the question, are there any grown-ups working for newspapers these days? So we look forward to seeing how this one plays out in court, wherever that court may be. The phony war of launch season, massive amounts of fakery in the car images, whether it was the much advertised new AI features of Adobe Photoshop that were being used or just the same old man or woman with an airbrush doing it. Lots and lots of fakery there. And last but not least, in what can only be a premature April Fool gag, Formula One's commercial rights holder issued a statement in which, amongst several other fatuous claims, it said that the Andretti name carried very little value to Formula One. Now, where to start on this? Shall we talk cars? Shall we talk about Red Bull's potential Icarus moment? Because that car looks very different. And we know they turned the development taps off, Matt, in the middle of last year, because they could. Obviously, work has been proceeding behind the scenes and a lot of new ideas put into that car. And yeah, very, very strange.
Yes, you know, no updates after Zandvoort, and I suppose we all assumed that the RB20 would be a pretty obvious evolution converging around this downwash side pod with the sort of what we've termed the underbite inlet, where the lower surface juts out, and that's what everyone else is slowly zeroing in on, because it's third year of these rules, stable rule book, convergence, diminishing returns. All the cars will look the same. And then Red Bull peeled back the covers and it looks a lot like a Mercedes from last year with those. We're struggling to narrow down what to call them, a high waistline, the cannons around the engine cover, gullies we've called them, but those sort of high haunches that really raise, it looks like they obviously they don't, but raise a sort of, as you look at it, the visual center of gravity, to use an excruciating turn of phrase. But those, and then at the launch of the RB20, that was sort of normal car. And then you got below the R of Oracle on the side pod, and someone had just basically welded a girder across, so it had taken away any like definition or intricacy away from the floor. So that's obviously not the spec running in Bahrain. And then if I might blow my own trumpet, a story I was working on, we ran on Autosport and motorsport.com, is that we believe pre-season testing in Bahrain, then the opening Grand Prix, Saudi Arabia, a trip to see Mark in Australia, and then after that it goes to Japan where it's much cooler, and then the Red Bull will come to look like the Mercedes of last year even more, with some heavily shrink wrapped side pods, which obviously is a big departure, a bit of a risk for Red Bull, but also like it's almost as if Adrian Newey, Pierre Bachet got, you know, things have died down a bit after Abu Dhabi 2021. How can we really upset the Mercedes fans again? Let's take the concept that they have completely failed to unlock over the past 2 years and let's nail it. And yeah, so it's pleasing to see such a departure. And I would have loved, you know, I hope Netflix has used their access for good and had a camera in the office of Toto Wolff and James Allison when everyone else has converged around this Red Bull design, and they pulled the covers off, and as everyone's gone one way, Red Bull's gone the other way.
It's just beautiful, isn't it? It's just such a fillip, really, at a time when everyone thought we were in for more predictability. And it's just a beautiful piece of engineering trawling between Milton Keynes and Brackley. I've got a suggestion for you in terms of that very high waistline. We could call it a muffin top, couldn't we? Would that be possible? But anyway, that's probably
minute
not
that. Yeah, let's do that.
It's not an attractive description of the car. And I was watching a film the other day on YouTube of Adrian Newey talking about his new yacht, which is being built by Oyster Yachts in the UK. This is his yacht that he's going to sail off around the world when he finally decides to hang up his sketch pad. And he was talking about his love of innovation and attention to detail and doing things a little bit differently. And I was watching that film, and then I looked at the launch of the car and I thought, my goodness, you know, he just didn't want that evolution. There was, you know, there was a little ticking going on in his head, thinking, where can we go next? How can we take this concept further? You know, you would just love to know that when Mercedes brought out their concept a couple of years back, that Adrian looked at it and thought, no, there's an idea. Might be a bit premature, but let's have a look at that. And then, you know, 2 years later is able to bring out a version of it which works. And it's going to be really interesting to see. This is why I would love to be in Bahrain with you, Matt, because I think, you know, the next sort of 72 hours of that pre-season testing, all the BS that you hear over the car launches and livery reveals and everyone talking about, you know, their hopes for the new season, it all comes to a grinding halt once the stopwatch gets running in pre-season testing, and we'll see what the truth of all of this is. But I just love the fact that deep curiosity that Adrian has for seeing where he can take concepts further remains firmly intact. And after a year in which they won all but one of the Grand Prix, evolution was passed over in favour of a bit of revolution. It's great to see.
It was interesting that many years ago, when Adrian first moved to Red Bull, and you know he's written in his autobiography and given interviews where he said about how a little bit about the culture needed to change, and his obviously the first car that bore the new authorial stamp was sort of one year after he joined, and that one I forget what the model number of it was off the top of my head. It was very different from previous Red Bulls, and it was obviously a lot more aggressive in terms of the design parameters it set, but it also just kept falling to bits, like the floor would fall off or bend or whatnot, and it was really, really hard for them to get working in the opening races, and there was lots of typical Adrian Newey car. But you know, by hook or by crook, a couple of years later they got there. And you know, there are always different interpretations of innovation, aren't there? When you look at the McLaren he designed that in theory never raced, the MP418, I think, that probably was recycled into the 19, but a car that in theory never actually raced. And I have a book coming out in the middle of the year, McLaren Formula One car by car. It's a little bit like my Ferrari F1 car by car, but in McLaren form. And Neil Oakley, longtime McLaren engineer, very kindly offered to have a look through it and observe any journalistic cock-ups. And everything was fine. Around that sort of time, the MP418, he saw things very differently than Adrian Newey did about that car and what was wrong with it and the way forward and the circumstances around it being shelved. So very, very interesting process to go through in terms of understanding how innovation sometimes doesn't quite go how it should have been. Certainly that McLaren was a step too far in terms of the materials science at the time and what was expected of it. And as Alex Wirtz said, there was only one occasion where he set a lap quicker than the MP417 in it, and then never again. And then just bits were falling off, suspension collapsing. He after one particularly big shunt caused by a suspension collapse, he phoned Martin Whitmarsh and said, "I'm very sorry, I can't drive this car again." And Martin apparently said to him, "Yeah, I understand precisely why you've called, and I was expecting it." But at the same time, this was 20 years ago now, so the world's moved on, and I think material science has caught up with the aerodynamic ideas in Adrian Newey's brain. The question is, how long will it take rival teams to catch up? Because a lot of them have zigged, Matt, and Red Bull have zagged. Who's been the biggest zig?
Well, these cars are two-year cars, aren't they? We know we've got stability for next year, and then resources will go into massively into 2026. So, yeah, if anyone's massively cut adrift, Ferrari, the one I keep coming back to, that they have zagged when everyone's zigged with their rear suspension, then that design will be locked in. And I think, you know, just to go back to what Mercedes are thinking, because their ground effect sort of history, and very brief, is that they thought ground effect era, the floor is the most critical part of the device. So let's really shrink that back, shrink wrap the bodywork, these zero side pods, to expose as much as the floor as possible. They got, you know, they simulated really good numbers in the wind tunnel, but then they got to a real track and realized it's not like a wind tunnel. There's lumps and bumps. So for last year, they raised the car massively. And then they found that there was an aerodynamic performance ceiling. There was only so much faster they could go. So they put the car in the middle, and rather than go into like a Goldilocks sweet spot, it was there. Nothing was running as how it was designed to be set up. So maybe the third attempt, where they designed it all around that middle height, it would have been brilliant. But obviously they've I can understand why, to sponsors, shareholders, Lewis Hamilton, you can't justify going for a third time at doing something that's not worked. But then Red Bull have done that's what the Mercedes W15 could have looked like. I think that's a brilliant bit of design. And, you know, just to show what sort of plane Red Bull are operating on at the minute, by focusing on, you know, a really narrow sort of architecture, the side pod structures, it means that they can spend a lot of time repackaging the internals. That's all free. They can do that as much as they like. And then basically they need to bolt on a couple of carbon fiber panels and then shape the airflow on top. So despite them being constructors champions and eating, you know, and obviously losing more of their wind tunnel time from exceeding the cost cap, they've massively offset that damage by focusing on cooling and still getting performance out of it. So it just shows you what sort of level they're operating at the minute. But it is a case, is it too big of a departure? Have they unsettled the car going into testing? Obviously there's bigger picture stuff going on at Red Bull. And testing, you're never going to know the ultimate lap time because of fuel loads, tire life, engine modes. But you can definitely tell when a team's, you know, in a bit of crisis, whether that was Mercedes last year, whether that was, you know, going to turn 9s 10 at Bahrain and watching Verstappen hit every apex and Perez, you know, understeering into a different county and how that sort of narrative played out. So there are definitely indications, and you can tell, you know, Allison and Hamilton have said you can tell from lap one whether basically my colleagues can start spending their championship winning bonuses or not. So if Leclerc is coming out and basically kicking the pavement and Sainz is actually quite upbeat thinking I've only got a year left of this before I'm out, then you'll know that Ferrari are in the doldrums. So, you know, again, maybe it is going to be another 23 races of Red Bull domination, but I hope it's coming across. I'm quite G'd up going into testing at the minute.
I always find this period quite amusing in that you see once the cars come out onto the circuit, you see the vast differences between them and the renders that were released. And there are certain places on the Bahrain circuit where you can stand and you can actually see where a car is in trouble or not. And that sort of the turn 9-10 you just mentioned, Matt, there's that super little control tower you can climb up. And if you're like me and being an idiot and haven't brought a hat, you hide in the shade and watch as, you know, the Red Bulls, absolutely beautiful, hitting every apex. Other cars, you know, mentioning no names, Mercedes, Alpine last year, sailing past and thinking, oh, I should have sent the apex a postcard. It's very, there is nowhere to hide once you start lapping, is there?
No, I mean, I think that's the actually truly remarkable feature of Formula One 2024, is that the technology has moved on to such an extent that literally these 3 days of testing validate whether the numbers are right or wrong almost instantly. And it's, when you think about decades gone by of Formula One, where particularly back to the days of unlimited testing, when there was unlimited testing, there was unlimited variation of what people were trying out, and it was hit or miss, and there was a just a question of throwing ideas at the wall. Now it's so much more scientific. And, you know, frankly speaking, by Friday night, Matt, whenever you're having your drink at the end of testing, you'll all be able to sit around and ponder what's just happened. Who's smiling, who's not smiling, who's in serious trouble. And I think that's what makes it so fascinating. I mean, of course, from the fans' point of view, certainly from a listener's point of view, it means that these next 3 days are going to be critical. And by the time the cars hit the track in Bahrain for the Grand Prix itself, there'll be already an extremely good picture of what's likely to happen. And it's the beginning of Formula One's longest ever season. So if a team has got its numbers wrong, And, you know, to your point, Matt, if Carlos Sainz is literally counting the days to when he leaves Ferrari, well, there's a lot of days when he's going to have to race that car this year. And, you know, I, for one, hope that, you know, Ferrari have made a step forward, because it would be nice to see a degree of upset this year. I think that's what's exciting, is the as we're recording this, there's unpredictability in the air. So let's see what the testing brings, and we'll soon know whether Adrian Newey, James Allison, and all the other technical bosses have gotten their numbers right or wrong.
It is, from the point of view of being the editor of a monthly magazine that's had to compose their season preview issue before any of the cars have actually left the garage, it is actually as annoying as hell for the launches and the pre-season tests to be that close to the first race. But at the same time, and I'm willing to argue this point, it does concentrate the excitement, doesn't it? You know, in years past, when there was unlimited testing and you'd have one team hiring out Barcelona for a few days, and it would just be that one car running, and you could turn up at any time and they were just doing anything because they had unlimited time. Testing was a little bit dull, whereas now... testing is, I wouldn't say it's massively exciting in terms of Grand Prix style narrative where there's a beginning, a middle and end, but there are sort of emerging threads that you can track through the days and you can see how the cars are running. And because it's concentrated in that short space of time, I think the excitement levels are that much greater. I still don't know why, like, bloggers turn up and live blog it as if it's a Grand Prix practice session, but I suppose that's dictated by exigencies of needing the traffic. But it's certainly, well, the proof is in the pudding of Matt being there leaping up and down with excitement on my little screen at the thought of going to see some cars going around track tomorrow.
No, I'm sure that'll be knocked out of me soon enough. But it is. I think with testing as well, this might just be a me thing, but it just feels naughty fundamentally, because you've got this whole track in the middle of desert, only 10 cars. You might only see one every couple of minutes, but there's no one else there. There's a few marshals, you know, who are... I'm not trying to downplay their work, but it's very hot. So they're, you know, nicely tucked into some shade, maybe even on their phones a little bit, not really paying interest. And you don't see anyone. It feels naughty that you're there almost, that you've got this place to yourself and you're spying on these prototypes going testing. So I think it excites the boyhood charm a bit. Having said all of this, I've just recalled that at the launch, Newey said of the Silverstone filming day, the car performed as expected, which is Newey speak for, oh yeah, this is another one. Sort of, it's you know, no unreliability, no catching bodywork. So maybe I'm getting a bit ahead of myself. But you know, how will McLaren factor in, you know, the Horner shadow over the test? It's the first time everyone's been in the same place since the Andretti rejection. So hopefully we haven't had like an embarrassment of riches in terms of good news stories to start the year, and then it'll fizzle out from here on in. But certainly I think there's, you know, just in terms of speaking to people, getting off the record information to sort of fill in the cracks and sort of complete the narrative of a few story arcs, I think, yeah, it'd be good to see people. And Bahrain catering is good as well, which always helps.
Oh yes, the Andretti rejection sounds like a abandoned title for a Robert Ludlum continuation novel, doesn't it? One of the few that's not going to be turned into a film starring Matt Damon.
I was about to say it has to be starring Matt Damon.
I mean, they might Netflix it and have a sort of lesser known action star in the seat. Shall we dig into that a little bit? I mean, I read that release from Formula One with increasing cadences of credulity, or should that be decreasing? Increasing cadences of incredulity. Obviously we know that the person who writes their press releases up until recently worked in politics. You know, he was a spin doctor for Boris Johnson when he was mayor of London. So what he knows about Formula One and its history can be composed on quite a small piece of paper. Nevertheless, we do have the internet nowadays, and a little Google of the Andretti name would have revealed to even a layperson that the sentence, how did it actually go? The Andretti would receive more value from Formula One than Formula One receives from Andretti. Not a statement that holds or stands up to any scrutiny whatsoever. And yes, listener, I WTF'd. Mark, Matt, did you have similar spasms as you read this release?
Well, my overwhelming feeling as I read the statement was that it was extraordinary that whoever wrote it decided that they needed to make 20 points as to why Andretti wasn't worthy of having an entry in Formula One. It felt like about at least 15 points too many. You should be able to sum up the reason why a team is not eligible or doesn't meet the entry requirements within, you know, three or four key points. There was only a couple of points that actually made some sense to me, and this is based on conversations I've had with team principals who have met with Michael Andretti and who have been familiar with some of their plans. And the couple of reasons that really resonated were the points around, this perhaps not being a team that fully understands the scale of the challenge involved in coming into Formula One, that, and they mentioned this point around designing a car for the 2025 regulations under the current regulations and a completely new car for the 2026 regulations. And of course, while I'm reading this, I'm thinking, I'm assuming that they've had the relevant conversations with Andretti. When Andretti then rebut that point by saying, actually, that wasn't going to be the case. And by the way, we never did have a meeting because the invitation to have a meeting with Formula One went into our spam folder. And then I'm thinking, Formula One seriously sent an email to Andretti, didn't get a response, and didn't follow it up with a phone call to say, did you get our email? I mean, this is basic business efficiency, courtesy, whatever you want to call it. So the statement was way too long. The good points that were in it sort of quickly started to become undermined by Andretti's rebuttal. I thought the point about, Formula One as a brand brings more to Andretti than Andretti brings to Formula One was a completely unnecessary statement to make. It was, quite frankly, a cheap shot. It was the way I looked at it. And I was surprised that Formula One agreed that this was a statement worth issuing. There's clearly been a, as I mentioned in my column in the magazine a couple of months ago, the president of the FIA, Mohammed bin Sulayem, who we're going to talk about in a few moments' time, I mean, he handed the poison chalice over to F1 by announcing that Andretti met all of the FIA's criteria in terms of entering. So it was always going to be the case that Formula One had been put in a position where if it was going to reject Andretti, it needed to come up with a really good, really good, really compelling reason. And this 20-point press release didn't really provide that compelling reason. It just looked like a little bit of a closed shop, almost cartel-like approach to protecting Formula One's existing teams. To read it was quite shocking because it felt like a statement that had been cobbled together. What other reason can we come up with? What is another point that we could make to, underline why we're not allowing Andretti to come in? So they just added point after point. But so from that point of view, it didn't seem particularly coherent. And therefore, we don't really know the reason beyond what we surmise, which is that this is all to do with money and it's to do with protecting the existing 10 teams, the existing business formula that's working very well under the current commercial agreements. And it's very much a case of, that change is not something that the existing teams and Formula One want to see happen. So it remains it remains a point of serious contention. And having been in America for the last 4 weeks, and I don't need to tell you what the most frequently asked question was whenever I, you know, was speaking at some of these corporate events, which I do, American fans want to know what's wrong with Andretti. Why will Formula One not allow 11th team to come in? And there is a huge interest in seeing that take place. I think particularly when you talk to fans in the United States, you know, the Cadillac brand, that General Motors involvement, for them is a really important pillar of the Andretti case. So it's not as if they're trying to wing it. The money is there, the desire is there, the brands are there to add some value to Formula One. I mean, why would Andretti and Cadillac not add value in terms of the brands that they represent and that they can bring to the sport? So again, the more, you know, when you're talking to fans over there, that 20-point statement doesn't really, for them anyway, it doesn't really stack up. And I'm sure this is why Andretti are just going to continue plugging along. What's going to be very interesting is what are the next steps that Andretti take, because I don't think they're going to be giving up anytime soon, particularly so long as they have the full support of the president of the FIA.
Yeah, just coming back to that point on value, and this is a genuine question rather than me going on a rant, and, you know, listeners can email matt.q@autosport.com, but is there any brand not in Formula One that could bring more value to F1 than F1 can bring value to it? Because the only reason, you know, no massive car company, whether it's BMW, Toyota, to pick a couple that aren't in F1 at the minute, none of them whom have to answer to shareholders and investors are going to sign off on an F1 program unless they think they'll get something out of it. So they have to get value out of F1. You know, but you know, unless it was like Elon Musk bankrolling Tesla, which focuses purely on being disruptive and has no interest in internal combustion engines, so there'll be a sort of what the hell curiosity factor. Outside of Tesla, who could set up an F1 team and that would be the bigger story than F1 itself? I just don't buy that argument. And okay, the process has changed since Haas came in 2016. But, you know, the point that F1 says you can't bring in one car and then undergo a massive rule change the year after because of technical capabilities. Well, Haas did that, was somewhat competitive. And the Andretti camp has come out and said, well, basically, you took so long in replying to us that the timelines have changed now. We're focused on 2026. The fact that, you know, the tone seems really clear to me that F1 goes, we'll invite, you know, particularly a team with involvement from General Motors to apply again in 2028. That sort of final bullet point focuses entirely on General Motors and nothing of Andretti, which makes it feel almost personal, really. And what I'm about to say is not saying that we should throw out any existing F1 teams to make way for Andretti. But you look at Haas, where the reason Günther Steiner, who, you know, pretty much is the only reason that team is recognisable in the wider world, Günther Steiner, the reason he is gone is because Gene Haas has said, why is my team doing poorly? And Günther has gone because you're not spending an extra $200 million. And his second in command has gone, no, with the resources you currently have, I can get you success for cheaper. So, you know, if in the fullness of time, Komiatsu leads that team to greatness, then fair enough. But otherwise, Haas is massively underinvesting in its team, just a tool around at the back. Then you've got RB and Sauber Stake. Both have equally offensive team names, you know, for sort of placeholder companies that no one really knows the identity. It makes it look weak, like a British Touring Car Championship team name, et cetera, which is harsh on a British Touring Car Championship. What's the value they're bringing? Why, you know, what? I'm not saying that those two need to go or those three teams need to go, but if that's the current benchmark being set by the incumbents, and Andretti, from every measure that we've seen, and you have to presume that F1 have seen, bearing in mind they haven't had a one-to-one meeting with anyone, you know, the email invited them ended up in a spam folder. I mean, blimey is all I can say, blimey. That they don't have any more information than us. It's really bad. And, you know, the whole process undermines the disagreement between the FIA and F1. And the whole process started. It's basically a vanity project. The FIA want to go, oh, loads of people are interested after Drive Survive. Let's see how many are there. But as you know, and it's been really poorly executed from the start of the FIA not really having a proper justification for opening up the new team application process, not one that stands up to much scrutiny, to the latest chapter, which is that, as we've all said, abysmal F1 rejection that, you know, makes it look like F1 is a closed shop, not only to America, but what other force is competing in motorsport at the minute that could get a significant, you know, manufacturer the size of GM who are willing to commit to an engine program? What, I can't think of anything in the motorsport pipeline that would therefore sort of surpass the threshold that F1 have set by rejecting Andretti General Motors. So, you know, 10 teams it is until the next recession, which we're currently in, and they all go. I don't know.
So that was a marvellous rant. Do you know, I've got an idea. We did mention Boris Johnson earlier. Perhaps, I'm just throwing this idea out there, what's needed is an away day for all the stakeholders concerned to Peppa Pig World. No?
No sentence with Boris Johnson, amazing idea. I can listen to it, I'm afraid.
Okay, well, returning to the rest of our season preview issue, we did have a reasonable presumption of strength on behalf of Red Bull. So we focused on prospects of some of the chasing pack, and Andrew Benson has composed a marvellous analysis of where Lando Norris is and explodes a few myths about how much pressure he's under from Oscar Piastri. Because I remember at the tail end of last year, the talk was all about, oh, you know, he's starting to make mistakes under pressure. Piastri's got him rattled and whatnot. So I said to Andrew, because we always have an absurdly long phone call even before I compose the brief that I send to him, where he shoots down any ideas that I might have that are wrong or whatever. And I just said to him, you know, why don't we sort of begin by shooting down the popular narratives surrounding Lando Norris, which is that he's choking under pressure. And Andrew said, well, yes, right, I can do that. Let's do that. And yeah, it became pretty clear once you dig into the figures that there were occasional moments of self-harm in qualifying, but actually a very good score against Piastri in qualifying and an average over the season of 0.184 seconds faster in qualifying sessions where they can be directly compared. So where do we think Lando Norris is based on that?
Well, I thought it's a very interesting piece to read, because the thing that comes across very clearly is the degree of Lando's commitment to the team and his own disarming honesty about those moments when he, you know, felt he let the side down. And as you mentioned, you know, there were errors, you know, unforced errors in qualifying, and he had to work hard to come back from those, and it blotted his copybook. And yet, again, to the point you make, over the course of the year, when you really do an analysis, this is a guy who continues to be able to perform at the very highest level. And there's a huge amount of excitement still, I think, around Norris, and rightly so, because of his temperament, his work ethic, the fact that, yes, he makes mistakes. When we talk about mistakes, what are we talking about? Well, you know, if you think about occasions when, you know, he exceeded track limits, you know, he's pushing hard, makes a couple of errors, pays dearly for that, recognizes that, is happy to, you know, happy to take that on the chin. He knows he's got the confidence of the team behind him. He has a great relationship with the senior leadership there. And the Oscar Piastri point, I think, for me, is an interesting one, because what you've got there is a pair of drivers who push each other. And in pushing each other, they push each other both for good and now and again, they'll push each other over the limit. They'll be pushing hard to assert their position, to to do. And so we're talking about life at the limit, you know, with two very strong teammates. And of course, the improvements that McLaren made last year, that revision to the car over, I think it was over three races just at the beginning of the summer, you know, it's just worked so well. It was one of the really interesting points. Again, we've just been talking about what's lying ahead in 2024. Looking back in 2023, you know, it was such an interesting season, the ebb and flow of car development and competitiveness. And I think the Oscar Piastri sensation, you know, which he was in last season, was always going to perhaps cast a slight shadow across Lando. So I thought this is a really interesting piece. It kind of redresses that balance, and he comes across very well because of that, as I say, that temperament, the confidence that he has in himself and the team, and his self-awareness, and, you know, recognizing that there's still room for improvement is so important in any sports person, no matter what level they're at. And I think, you know, Lando's going to be all the stronger for that this year. He just, you know, he'll have to double down and focus even more on making sure he gets those laps banged in perfectly in the way that perhaps eluded him on a couple of occasions last year.
Yeah, nothing is unimprovable, only unimproved, Matt.
As you always say about my coffee, Connors. Quite. Yeah, I was wanted to touch on Andrew Benson's sidebars as well, where he talks about going to Red Bull, because there's a good point where he addresses sort of Norris versus Verstappen, because after Verstappen signed his most recent contract extension, a lot of people, I think, ever so slightly misinterpreted him as he said, you know, along the lines of I'm settled at McLaren and, you know, I don't want to go up against Max Verstappen. And people took that, I think, to mean as he thinks in the same team he would be exposed, or, you know, that Verstappen is the better driver and he's not willing for the fight. But I think, you know, Benson touches upon it in a side pod that, actually, it's what he's leaving behind. He is, you know, Piastri has run him close, but that team is naturally going to lean towards Lando Norris. He's a, you know, more experienced hand, quicker, you know, he's been a junior driver since 2017. Is he going to basically jack that all in to go to a team where it so clearly revolves around its number one driver, you know, more now than it ever has done for on track, off track, you know, reasons? You can see how everything is geared towards Max Verstappen. To throw back to last year, that doesn't mean that they're upgrading the car with parts that were specifically hurt Sergio Perez just to help Max Verstappen. But, you know, he has been there a long time, and you're obviously going to galvanize around the sort of the lead protagonist. So why is Norris going to jack that all in? And it's, you know, it bodes well for F1 that McLaren has given him enough of cause, enough optimism to stay and commit his future. I was reading Benson's bit, and I did ever slightly, you know, that point about, is it a complete myth that Norris chokes? Because I sort of agreed and disagreed with Benson. So in a sense that he says Norris did sort of blunder in, let's say, Q3 in Abu Dhabi, where there's a plausible pole and he the car snapped him on turn 13. But I thought, is that a Norris error? Is that actually because McLaren have admitted that with those upgrades, they did introduce some really tricky handling traits into it? So maybe that one was more his car. And I totally get the point that with these rubbish Pirelli tyres we've got at the minute, that Norris, Leclerc, whoever, they'd be pretty foolish actually to try and put up a protracted battle against Verstappen when he's coming back through the pack. But I still thought, was it turn one at Brazil? Was it the sprint race where Norris was a bit weak there, sort of got a superior launch? And then at the balcony at the end of the media centre, which did catch on fire in Brazil, Rope Electronics, we get a good view of turns one, two and three. And sort of, you know, and I thought, okay, I can justify, I'm not writing the race report for autosport.com on the flag, I can justify going and watching the race start. So I saw it and expecting Norris to be there or thereabouts since turn one, and he was two car lengths back already. So that did, I think, yeah, absolutely give rise to the storyline that, you know, he might be choking ever so slightly. But, you know, if he hadn't just signed that new long-term contract, he would be top of Toto Wolff's calling list, if there's any doubts about Antonelli. I'm sure of that. And I think it's really interesting that certainly the the two teams that spiced up the narrative last year and may well do so at the start of this year were Aston Martin and Norris. And basically the two different ways to skin a lead driver in Norris and Fernando Alonso. I think that's a fascinating comparison in itself. But yeah, Norris is a fantastic driver. And I think he sits in that top bracket of F1, doesn't he? He's among the elite with the Leclerc, Hamilton, Verstappen is really the lead guys and should be around for a lot longer winning. And I think it will come. He has a talent and McLaren's on the right path to win races rather than have the epithet, you know, a Martin Brundle style greatest driver never to win a race, a Moss style greatest driver never to win a title. I think he should get there.
Yeah. And he's a very different character as well in terms of the way he presents to the outside world than the other drivers, which I think is good, because there was a time when racing drivers were a bit homogenous in their shall we say their interactions with the outside world, and just made it a bit more difficult to package it for TV and package it in a magazine. Speaking of characters, this month elsewhere in the magazine, we have an exclusive interview with the FIA president, Mohammed Ben Sulayem. He's a very uncompromising character, likes to make his opinions heard. And Oleg went to interview him and, well, he spoke lots of fascinating revelations. I didn't realise that the FIA president, when he was young, used to nick his dad's car while the driver was, you know, off having a cigarette break or whatever. And he'd park it very carefully after he'd finished to make sure he escaped detection. But eventually he was rumbled. And it's kind of fascinating in that regard. And there's also the story about how he contested a rally after breaking his neck, and he essentially got his doctors to fuse it together and, you know, the $6 million man routine so he could go and carry on competing. And that sort of approach of not letting a setback like that upset his sense of purpose has kind of come to define his presidency, hasn't it? Because, you know, he's got ideas, and you sort of see in the interview that occasionally he'll be answering one question and then he'll just stop and start launching into a point about, say, you know, the relationship between the FIA and F1, and try and tie it into the reply he's making. But actually, no, he's just having a rant or something. So it must have been quite a fascinating thing for the photographer to sit and watch while Oleg kind of got, asked his questions, but then wasn't quite sure what was going to come back. You know, it's a really, really interesting interview. And I know that the president is a little bit sort of love him or hate him, but actually, you know, he is part of motor racing's life's rich tapestry at the moment, isn't he?
Yeah, but really interesting piece with the FIA president. It reminded me of something I was already aware of from the past, which is, you know, being as I'm from Belfast in Northern Ireland, he was educated there. He did his bachelor's degree at Ulster University, and he subsequently was awarded a doctorate from the same university when he became a multiple Middle East Rally Champion. But the thing that's so interesting about reading the piece is that, you know, he comes across as having such, you know, quite strident opinions about things. Formula One in particular, of course, which, you know, Oleg correctly, you know, quizzes him about. He's not short of stories about what motivates him, the fact that he loves it when someone tells him he can't do something, because he then sets out on a very determined, you know, course to achieve that. I thought it was an interesting anecdote in the piece, you know, without giving the game away about the whole feature. It was an interesting point that he made about when he was campaigning for presidency, he was being urged to, you know, develop a strong social media presence. And he made the point to his advisors that he only needed to woo over 120 member clubs of the FIA in order to, you know, secure the presidency. And actually, he only needed just over half of that number to come on board. And so he was playing the political game. And, you know, politics is something that, you know, he seems to relish. I found the piece a little bit disappointing for some of the omissions in it, because it's been far from a bed of roses for Formula One, for motorsport, since he became president. He inherited a mess. He talks about the financial mess that he inherited, which of course Jean Todt disputes completely. the mess that I'm thinking of is that his presidency began, you know, within a week of the 2021 Formula One World Championship climax, which, you know, with the passage of time, it doesn't get any better, does it? You know, in terms of what happened there and the fact that there was a gulf, you know, the leadership of the FIA was missing in action at precisely the time when the sport needed strong leadership. And in fact, he goes on in the piece to talk about how highly he regards Michael Massey and sees him as being, you know, potentially part of the future for the FIA. And I mean, I agree with the points that he made about Michael Massey personally. And you know, I've met Michael Massey. He's a, you know, well-intentioned guy. But the fact remains that what happened in Abu Dhabi at, you know, just on the eve of Mohammed bin Salim's presidency is not something that he could or should gloss over. There has been a serious undermining of the FIA's reputation and the governance of the sport. There have been some very unfortunate comments made during his presidency about all kinds of, you know, quite frankly, surprising matters in terms of, you know, Lewis Hamilton's non-attendance at the FIA Awards following the Abu Dhabi issue, the jewellery, you know, matter, the, you know, a few other things which were mentioned in terms of the campaigning that Lewis has done. It left a bitter taste in terms of the way things could have been better handled by the presidency. And it's a very, very different style of presidency. And that comes across very clearly in the interview. So it's great to have secured this insight into the man and the way that he thinks about it. He's in a combative mood. And a point I would make is that during my career, I've met some very combative people in Formula One. And I have often come to the conclusion that it doesn't actually ultimately get them very far because they just go from one battle to the next. And ultimately, what are you achieving? There is a good reason why leaders try and get a collegiate approach, surround themselves with the best people, get the best outputs, ensure that, you know, they create stability and growth and positivity. And we've only just finished talking about the Andretti saga, and the fact is that the FIA and Formula One are at loggerheads over this 11th team issue, and it's a running sore at the moment, and it's difficult to see an easy resolution to that. So whilst it's in some ways easy for the incumbent president to point out that Formula One is simply being leased to the rights holder at the moment, It is a 100-year lease. We're 20 years into that now, but it is a long-term lease. Not really much point in pointing that out. No one involved is going to be around when that, you know, deal comes up to be discussed. So let's deal with where we actually are today rather than sort of point scoring over, you know, the fact that Formula One was leased for 100 years to the commercial rights holder. That's just literally, it's not ancient history. It's distant into the future.
Recent history.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, yeah, really good to get that interview, I thought, with him. And it just confirms many of the things that we suspect about his approach to the governance and the politicking around Formula One and motorsport at the moment.
Matt, you've often had to dive out of the way of the president and his entourage, led, of course, by Dieter Renken, our former colleague, on the grid. I mean, he does like to be a high-profile presence, but I actually quite like the fighting for what he believes in angle, whereas I always thought John Todd was a little bit too distant and a little bit too regal in his bearing for my liking, whereas Mohammed bin Salim sort of comes in fists swinging if required, which is quite refreshing.
Yeah, two very different contrasting styles of leadership. Both of whom had massive detractors. I interviewed John Todd a number of times when I was covering Formula E, because that was, you know, a massive part of his legacy in his final few years of his presidency. And I, you know, I didn't always find him particularly agreeable, or his answers satisfactory. And, you know, they're fair complaints made against Ben Soloyam as well. Oleg is a fantastic, diligent reporter, but you do have a bit like with Fernando Alonso, you get the sense that you could ask any five questions and you'd sort of hit upon the same notes if they, you know, because, like, almost to Ben Soloyam's credit, rather than being disparaging of the media, like, you know, Norris is, who we talked about, you know, his disdain for the media is quite clear. At least Ben Soloyam sees it as an opportunity to peddle a certain narrative, even if, you know, the way he goes about it is a bit, you know, ham-fisted at times. So, you know, I'm sure going into Oleg's interview, he wanted to get on certain notes. And I also think he's, you know, he's shrewd enough, isn't he, to know that Oleg works for GP Racing magazine. So there's certain things to put in that part of the media. But then when he deals with, you know, people who are maybe work for the general reader broadsheets, he's, you know, peddling a different sort of agenda, or if it's for autosport.com, and he knows that basically within 25 minutes of him, you know, finishing his sentence, there'll be something online as well. There's another thing to feed. So he does play it to his game, but yeah, he's, and, you know, he makes sure he's in the center of certain shots, camera shots, and shaking hands with the right people. But the relationship between F1 or FOM and the FIA is particularly bad, that, you know, it is coming at the cost of the championship, that there is so much like cattiness going on behind the scenes where they think each other are clowns, and it's almost like handling a crash, and it's quite draining. It's like being the third wheel in a toxic relationship, really, just hearing the two partners complain about each other all the time. You're thinking, well, there is a middle ground here, and you're both way off it. But yeah, Ben Soloyam's leadership's, it's been a mixed bag at best, for the issues he's focused on, for the issues he's avoided. And obviously, you know, whether it's a campaign against him, or obviously the underlying thing is he never should have said or written those things, but obviously bits of his past keep cropping up, you know, really poorly judged comments on his blog and whatever, that it just, his career or his reign as FIA president, his administration never feels like it's got any momentum. It just does something, the hot take is it's bad, then something from his past comes, it's bad. And so it's a lot of it. It's a bit like MBS himself. It's just a whirlwind of energy, but I'm not sure quite how productive it all is, all said and done.
I'm fascinated by the metaphor of being a third wheel in a toxic relationship. I don't think that featured in the lyrics of the Britney Spears song at all. Anyway, we have come to the end of our podcast. We're about to hit the magic hour. And fortunately, we've done so without giving our producer, Torin, any palpitations over legals or anything like that. Palpitations, not the name of the evil emperor in the Star Wars trilogy. So there is plenty else to read in this month's GP Racing. Oleg also got to meet Zinedine Zidane along with the Alpine drivers. I'm led to believe Zinedine Zidane is a very good practitioner of what used to be known as association football. Now, you may wish to help us stay in business by taking out a subscription to our magazine. If you want to do so, go to gpracing.com. There are always fantastic offers on there. If you want to find the magazines on the shelves and you're thinking, does my local newsagent sell it? Well, you can find out. You can go to our distributor's website and go type in your postcode into their magazine finder. Go to www.seymour.co.uk and you can find their magazine finder. That is Seymour as in Seymour Bathurst, the 7th Earl Bathurst, decorated soldier in the Boer War, latterly owner of the Morning Post newspaper. Thank you very much to our special guest, Matt Q. You can go and have that much needed afternoon nap after your hideous overnight flight.
I have a feature to write for Autosport magazine, so I'm afraid it's still all hands on deck, much like the increasingly loud construction workers outside the window. So I might have to don the headphones and put on some classic FM via VPN so I can sort of zero in on writing some engaging copy without, you know, sort of subconsciously referencing jackhammers and building foundations and whatever's going on outside my hotel window.
Well, do you know, it's an enormous feat of audio technology, but I don't think the listener has been able to hear them building Bahrain in the background while you've been speaking. A much more sedate background in Adelaide now he's actually got there. Thank you very much, Mark Gallagher, and you'll be next popping off to Melbourne for us, won't you?
Yeah, we've got. I've got a busy couple of events coming up in between now and our next podcast. I've got we've got the Adelaide Motorsport Festival, which has got Damon Hill returning to the scene of his victory here in 1995, final Adelaide Grand Prix. But of course, but he's coming back 30 years after that infamous collision with Michael Schumacher, which sorted out the 94 World Championship. Damon Hill's coming to the Adelaide Festival. So is Gunther Steiner, Valtteri Bottas, Paddy Lowe, interestingly, ex-technical director of Williams. He's coming down as well. And then Melbourne Grand Prix. So, yeah, it's going to be a busy month. Can't wait to see what happens to pre-season testing and the opening couple of races. So by the next time we all speak, we'll know who's a hero, who's a zero, and whether we're in for fireworks or tedium.
Well, hopefully fireworks, not so much tedium. We'll be back this time next month. Thank you for listening.